The audit, Legislative Audit Committee for April 4th, 2017. And I'd like to turn it over to our staff to let us know what she's presented to us here today on the dais.
Well, great. So you do have a packet of information in front of you, and there's extra copies with Michael. What you have here is really related mostly to the second item on the agenda, which is your committee discussion regarding criteria and recommendations, although I would note that the first attachment after the little memo is the Secretary of State's criteria for audits, so that will be something you might want to reference as they come up for the first item. Then what you have, I'm just going to briefly go through it and we can discuss it further, but then what you have is a short listing of some risk factors and categories and considerations that other states take into account, followed by three examples of what states use to actually gather requests for their legislative reviews or audits. And then the very last page is the list of suggested audit topics that we have at this point for the committee. So again, most of that will be for the second item, but I wanted to reference that that the first attachment there might be something you'd want to have in front of you as we invite the Secretary to say that.
Thank you very much. Okay, at this time then we have the Office of the Secretary of State Division of Audits.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Will Garber. I'm deputy director at the Audits Division. I'm up here by myself today, but my boss, Mary Wenger, is behind me, and I will call her up if I need a lifeline. But so I'm going to discuss three things that I understand the committee would like some more information on. One is basically what a performance audit is, what we consider them to be, and how that differs from a review, how we use risk assessment in our performance audit work, and a little bit more about how we set our audit schedule, including the selection criteria we use when we're choosing topics for the schedule. So I think the best place to go for a definition of a performance audit are the government auditing standards. They are issued by the U.S. Government Accountability Office, and they define a performance audit as an audit that provides findings or conclusions based on an evaluation of sufficient appropriate evidence against criteria. Performance audits provide objective analysis to help management and those charged with governance and oversight, improve program performance and operations, reduce costs, facilitate decision making, and improve public accountability. Performance audit objectives can vary. They can be assessments of program effectiveness, efficiency, internal control, and compliance. They can be fairly narrow in what they address, like an internal control assessment. Or they can cover a broad scope, like how well an agency is achieving its mission and goals. That also means they vary in terms of how long they last, too, depending on how big that scope is. But any audits that is done in conformance with auditing standards takes a certain amount of time to accomplish. They can't be done super quickly. But we think the standards are very important. We want the majority of our work to be done in accordance with the standards. They ensure our work is high quality and that our findings and conclusions are backed up by sufficient and appropriate evidence. Next, I was going to talk briefly about reviews, what we consider a review to be. The term review is actually not defined in the auditing standards. We use the term to describe relatively short engagements that are not done in accordance with all of the auditing standards. The most common way this would happen for us would be when we complete scoping on a particular audit topic and decide not to proceed with a full audit. Scoping's that initial phase where we're doing a lot of information gathering and trying to understand as best we can what challenges an agency faces. If we complete that scoping phase and we decide that we don't want to proceed with a full audit, we don't think it's warranted, we conclude the engagement at that point, and we may communicate the results in a short review or a management letter. An example that I can talk about from the past is some work we did at the Oregon Insurance Division, where we looked at their process for reviewing health insurance rates. We didn't think proceeding with a full audit was warranted, but we had useful information we wanted to report on the division's rate review process, so we did issue a very short review on that. We've also done some reviews where we knew from the outset that the scope would be relatively limited and not done as a typical audit in conformance with standards. An example I can cite from the past are what we called change of director reviews. They used to be required by statute. For those, we did a limited scope review. When an agency director left, we looked at a checklist of items to make sure that we didn't see any problems. And just one last thing I would note about reviews, we do relatively few of these, and as I mentioned, we want the majority of our engagements to be done in conformance with auditing standards. So the next thing I was going to move on to was talk briefly about how we use risk assessments as part of our performance audit process. And the main way we do this is after we've started an audit as part of the scoping phase. We think of challenges we identify during that scoping phase as risks, and they are risks that an agency or program may not be effectively or efficiently achieving desired goals and objectives. For each one of these risks that we identify, we think about the criteria that apply. That's what should be happening. This could be identified in laws, regulations, or agency policies. We also assess what we think is actually happening, and if performance is not what is expected, we assess what the effect of that could be. We typically identify several issues during the scoping phase, so thinking about them in this way is useful to us. It helps us judge the relative importance of the issues and where we should focus our audit efforts. We also use risk assessment in a more general way when we're considering which audit topics to put on our schedule, and that's the third thing I was going to talk about. So I talked a little bit about this in some prior testimony, but we set the audit schedule on a fiscal year basis. Throughout the year, we think about potential audit topics and record them in a database. That database is now swollen to some 300 or 400 ideas, so there's quite a few in there. We get ideas for audits from a number of sources. Some of the key ones are our own auditors. We ask them to be on the lookout for examples of challenges or failures in programs they see. Another source is the scoping work we conduct. I mentioned that we often identify several issues during scoping and only usually take up one or two. So the ones we don't take up are good candidates for future audit work. Members of the legislature make requests for audits. Agency directors sometimes do. We get ideas occasionally from our fraud hotline, and citizens occasionally will request audits. So near the end of the fiscal year, we begin the process of selecting the audits for the schedule. We have a team of auditors review what's in the database. Their goal is to try and come up with 30 to 40 really high priority topics. Then we have our management team get together and consider those 30 or 40 topics with the goal of trying to winnow that down to a list of 12 that we would put on our schedule. So once we do have that list of 12 together, of course, we provide it to the secretary for his input, make any needed adjustments, and that's what we put on the schedule. And the criteria part comes when we're thinking about what those topics are and selecting the ones for the schedule. The criteria that we use, we've actually laid out in that administrative rule you have in front of you. Probably the most basic one is that the audit lead to significant improvements in government programs that will have benefits for the public. I was prepared to go through, kind of walk through the other list of criteria. I don't know if you still want me to do that now that you've got them in front of you. Or
would you like?
Okay.
So one that's key is whether the topic is auditable. We need to know that we can get data to answer the audit question. We need to know that there's a feasible scope and methodology to do the audit. Audits that are required by legislation, of course, those are going to go on the schedule. Sometimes we've had ongoing audit requirements that establish audits over a period of time, and so we have some discretion about when we do those. But if it's required by legislation, of course, we'll put it on the schedule. Issues relating to an agency or program's ability to meet its mission, that's a key one for us. That's a pretty high priority. In fact, it's been a focus of a lot of the work we've done over the last 2 or 3 years. Just an example might help. We did an audit fairly recently at the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. We found that they had recurring cash flow problems, which really put their financial health in sort of an unsustainable path. So we actually, that was the first phase of the first audit. We did a second audit where we looked at how they could use strategic planning to try and sort of match up the resources they had with the demands on their time. Mm-hmm. Audit coverage, that's another thing we consider. I mean, we like to try and get around to all of the main agencies and programs over a certain interval. So if we haven't done them in a while, we'll put them on the schedule. Audits are topics that relate to public safety and vulnerable populations. That's another important one for us. In the past, we did an audit at Oregon Emergency Management. That's an example. We also did an audit recently at the Oregon Department of Agriculture where we looked at their food safety inspections. Significant challenges facing the state. This is another thing we think a lot about. And these can often lead to a series of audits, and probably the best way to illustrate this is with an example, and that's a series of audits we've done relating to improving K through 12 education, which is a big challenge the state faces. Some of the audits we did focus on, like improving teacher education and support. We looked at the achievement gap among minority and economically disadvantaged students and ways to address that. We looked at concerns about testing and ways to address those. And in fact, we have two ongoing audits in the education area, too, one looking at alternative education programs and also high school graduation rates. So that's just an example of one of these sort of challenges that the state faces, and they often lead to a series of audits on our part. Cost savings and revenue enhancements, we think about those. Efficiency and effectiveness, just topics that can increase economy efficiency or effectiveness of a program. High risk, large impact topics. I mean, these would be situations where we think the controls over a given program are fairly weak and the potential effects could be large. And that's really kind of an example of how we think about risk assessment during that audit selection process. And so is really the one I mentioned above about looking at an agency's ability to achieve its mission. If we think there's threats to that, we would consider that a high risk as well. Troubled agencies or programs, oftentimes we will get multiple ideas in our database about a given agency or program. That puts it on our radar screen, raises its priority level. Emerging and time-sensitive issues. We think about agencies facing emerging issues or problems, things that need to be addressed in the very near term. An example of an audit we did that I think was sort of time-sensitive was an audit we did of DHS's work environment. We sort of gauged their employees' engagement level there, and we actually put some audit work on hold to complete that. We wanted to have that there for the new director who had just recently arrived. So that's kind of, you can see there are quite a few criteria when we consider when we're deciding what topics to put on the schedule. The criteria aren't prescriptive. They don't necessarily dictate what we put on the schedule. But the process really requires some discussion and judgment on our part, just keeping all of those criteria in mind. Mm-hmm. So that's basically what I'd prepared on what a performance audit is, risk assessment, and the criteria we use for setting the schedule. I may not have covered everything you're interested in, though, so far away. If you have questions, I'll do my best.
Are there questions? Yes, Senator Thatcher.
Well, I was just going to try to find it, but then I didn't want to lose you. Anyway, I was looking for that list or database. Is that online on the Oregon Secretary of State's website?
The database that contains all of our topics is an internal one. It's not a public database.
It's just
an internal thing that we use to organize the large number of ideas we get.
And follow up to that?
Yes, please.
Have these been accumulating over the years, just kind of things that have just, like some of those topics might have been in there since, I don't know, 90s or something? Or
We don't have it yet. Co-chairs, Senator Thatcher, I'm sorry, I missed the protocol there. But, yes, there are audits that have been in there for some time, not the 90s. We put the database into effect probably, this is going to be a rough guess, I'm going to say about 6-8 years ago. And what we got was just a number of ideas and reports. We found that it was difficult to keep track of them all and to prioritize them. So this is a way we can do that.
Other questions? Yes. Senator Devlin.
I'm trying to think of a hypothetical couple of questions. First one is, let's say we decide to invest in a new human services program. And that program, let's say, is in addictions. And so we invest several million dollars. We want to see what the results of that are after, say, 4 years, in terms of where do you make the break between evaluating that program, whether it's been effective or not, and advocating for more funding, in a sense. I mean, is it the role of an auditor to, in essence, evaluate the program that they've been asked to audit? But where do you make the break when you say, well, this is not effective because there's not enough funding in this particular area? And I'm just trying to get the difference between an audit and actually more of a policy statement.
Right. Co-Chair McLean and Senator Devlin, I think I know what you're asking. I mentioned earlier that when we do performance audits, we really are trying to compare performance against some set of criteria. So it could be best practices. In your example, a drug addiction program, I think we could find best practices, maybe comparative criteria in other states who have similar programs. So that would allow us to say, how successful is the program? If it's not successful, one of the things we always try and do in audit is get at the cause. What's the reason for it not being successful? Sometimes that can boil down to lack of resources devoted to the program. But I'm trying to think if, I think we would be a little bit careful about just saying you need more, the program needs more money. I think we would try and be careful about what specifically the program needs, what it's lacking, and that would be that cause part of the finding that we're trying to flesh out.
Follow up, one that I have to be a little bit more careful on. There's at least one bill in the Senate that probably is not moving, but it's generated from an underlying skepticism about the rate setting process for community care organizations, in which the Oregon Health Authority contracts with an outside entity to basically develop data and to make recommendations on rates in compliance with numerous state and federal laws. Some of the questions about that is, you know, is it as objective as it's being portrayed? Because obviously there are parties within that are not satisfied with how the rates are being reset. And there does appear to be some pattern not affecting just one CCO, but several CCOs, in terms of routinely are seeing lower rates versus other CCOs. But is that an audible function? Is there a way you could come in and see if the outside contractor and the agency are actually performing this function in an objective fashion and not letting other criteria come into the rate-setting process?
Co-Chair McLean and Co-Chair Devlin, it's interesting you should ask that question, because we do have an audit that we've just started recently looking at Medicaid payments. And one of the things we're considering is payments to CCOs. What are they based on? Do they seem appropriate? That's one of the things that we're thinking about trying to cover in this audit. So back to your question, yes, I think as long as there's, you know, establish criteria for judging what those rates should be and how they should be set, it's something we could cover in an audit.
Okay. And then a last question, since I don't know if I'll have you back up here. One of our requests for consideration for an audit is to look at our own internal practices relative to pay equity in state agencies, both in terms of hiring, in terms of promotions, in terms of maybe disparities between similar classes paid differently dependent upon their, in this case, primarily focused on gender, but can be other factors. Without just, how would we actually present that to you as something that is auditable? Because it's on the surface, it's a fairly basic question. But how would you go about scoping out what you'd actually have to do to determine that? Because I think we have a pretty good demonstration in Ways and Means of just how many agencies we have, since it takes about 90 budget bills to actually pass all the budgets for all the state agencies. So how would you approach something like that? I mean, you have agencies that are the size of DHS across the street and agencies that have four people. So how would you approach, if we just gave you that basic question?
Co-Chair McLean and Co-Chair Devlin, I'm thinking about your question. In all of the audits that we do, obviously we have to, I mentioned this as one of our criteria, it has to be audible. We have to know that we can have data to answer the questions, and we have to have a feasible scope and methodology. So in the example you gave, I don't think it would be feasible for us to obtain data on every single agency in the state and comb through it. I think we'd have to come up with some kind of a methodology where we would select a sample of agencies and look at how well they're doing in terms of what the criteria are for equitable pay. Okay.
Representative Wisnett.
Chair is good?
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to go a little higher in my question. Since we've reconvened this committee, we've talked about what role the legislature should play and how we work together with the Secretary of State, realizing it's a separately elected officer. I think Senator Thatcher, when Secretary Richardson was here, Senator Thatcher, when Secretary Richardson was here, talked about whether the legislature should have an audit function. We've had a committee before, but we've never had an audit function. So in your testimony, you talked about citizens, that you would act upon a citizen request for an audit. I'm sure that you'd look at that, and, you know, with your expertise and stuff, and look at that. But I've read ahead to the South Carolina audit, and it looks like only the legislatures can request audit, and they even have to have five members or something like that. So I guess my question is, if we're trying to establish a new relationship or clarify a relationship, how do you feel about that? And do you have any data on how many you've acted on by the citizens and not coordinated with the legislature or things like that? So I'm trying to look at that level in our relationship and what, since we've reconvened to talking about how are we doing it, is the relationship right? How do we get the legislature more involved? How do we get items that we're really concerned about to the front of the line or something like that, I guess.
Co-Chair's Representative Wisnett, first about a citizen suggestion for an audit. We've had some of those. We would kind of consider those along with the other things that we have as potential audit topics. I can't think of a specific example where we've taken up an audit that a citizen requested, but there may be one there. I just don't know it off the top of my head. Getting to the issue about the relationship between the legislature and getting audits requested, this is something that the Secretary addressed in his comments in some previous testimony, and something that dates back to a prior session. But I think the committee being able to sort of filter requests that come in from members and let us know what the high priority topics are from the legislature's perspective would be very useful for us. And we do want to be able to put topics on our schedule that are important for members and for the legislature.
Follow up.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You use the word filter, and I agree, and we have to define what that word is we come up with. It doesn't have to be approved or at least coordinated or reviewed or something, but filtered is a good word. Can you have an idea of how many requests for audit you've received from the executive branch?
Co-Chair, as Representative Wisnett, I can think of specific examples where we've sat down with agency directors, say, and they've suggested topics. We did that several years ago with the director of the Oregon Health Authority. But a specific number, I'm sorry, I don't have that in mind right now.
Just to follow up, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's the executive branch is overseeing a lot of people, a lot of money, and I would expect, I would think that they should be one of your biggest customers along with the legislature, but that's not in fact true, in your opinion.
Oh, co-chairs, Representative Wisnett, pretty much every single audit we do is of the executive branch. It's of a program that
they're
the executive branch
mm-hmm.
oversees.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I have one. Representative Gomberg has been working on, and I talked to Representative Nathanson about this, and I was thinking about it going on a list, but it's a letter that's talking about liquidation and delinquent accounts receivable, so how we, you know, we get people to pay us. And in here it says there's $3.3 billion and over 2 million past due accounts. And one of the things that Representative Gomberg discusses a little bit is the fact that there's been six audits on collection since 1997, six of them. And that one of them that I think was as late as 2015, there's been some kind of indication that a lot of the suggestions have not been received or at least implemented. And when I say received, I mean, you know, internalized, I guess, to the point where there's people working on them. And so I was wondering about that side of auditing as you are auditing, and you evidently are keeping records of how many of these suggestions are being implemented. When you have something like this one, there doesn't seem to be a system in any of our agencies where we have a way that we're going to address these unpaid bills. And then there looks like there may be some suggestions or audits that have actually been done on collections, but that those haven't all been implemented. So I was wondering what you think about that and what's your reaction to that as far as your office or the Office of Secretary of State.
Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair McLean, there's a couple questions in there, I think. You mentioned the debt collection work we've done. I think you're right, the most recent one we did was in 2015. Mm-hmm. As I understand it, there are two or three bills in that the legislature is considering right now that would implement some of the recommendations we had in that audit.
Good.
As a general rule, just in terms of our process, when we have a regular process we go through to follow up on the recommendations that mm-hmm. we put in our reports, we wait about a year and then we get in touch with the agency and we have them provide us with a status and we record all of those statuses. We follow them for three consecutive years and continue to ask about the status. If an agency decides, if we think an agency is not making as much progress as they could, we might decide to focus an entirely new audit on that particular program and find out the reasons why. An example of that is the State Data Center. We had a series of audits that looked at security measures there, and we felt like we needed to keep sort of at that one because we weren't seeing the progress that we needed. But we can't force agencies to implement our recommendations. Mm-hmm. The legislature or Ways and Means Committee could ask an agency about the recommendations and why they haven't been implemented.
Well, that was a very good answer. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I think, Senator Devlin, I think when I first came in the building, we were trying to go after the debt, and we actually gave the Internal Revenue Service extra staff.
The Department of Revenue to
go after this.
Yes,
and
yeah,
they found that a lot of those were people in correction facilities mm-hmm. that were never going to have the money to pay it back. I think it was, mm-hmm. we tried, I know I've mentioned that to mm-hmm. President Gomberg. But.
Mm-hmm. Right, thank you. Are there any other questions?
Well, I guess yes. I'll throw it out there, Madam Chair. Thank you. There's one that I forgot to put on the list that had to do with economic development programs. This is something I've been trying to figure out for years now, the effectiveness of the different programs that we have. But I think before you even get to that point, you have to figure out what you have. And not everything that we have under the guise of economic development is housed in Biz Oregon. They're scattered. I mean, there are a whole bunch of things that have been passed over the years that we pat ourselves on the back and say, hey, we did this thing for small business. You know, we did this thing for small farms, whatever. And how effective are these things? And these things have just been sitting there. And I don't know how to even begin to, you know, eat that elephant. And maybe that's something you have looked into previously. I don't know. But I'd be wondering, how do you even start something like that?
Yeah, co-chairs, Senator Thatcher, there is the audit we did recently at Business Oregon. You probably read that. And one of the things that we talked about in that audit at a sort of very general level was being more transparent and collecting the data that would be necessary to judge whether those programs are being effective or not. So I think we had some recommendations in there about what Business Oregon could do in that regard. But, yeah, I think that having the data available is a key one to judging mm-hmm. whether they're successful or not.
Mm-hmm. Senator Riley.
Thank you. So in that vein, what we really want to know in most cases is the what-if question. What if we had not done this? Would we have had the same, worse, or better results?
Co-Chair Senator Riley, the but-for question is kind of the way we talk about that one. That's a tough nut to crack. Mm-hmm. I can't think of an audit methodology that gets at that right now. I mean, you could ask somebody who received some kind of a benefit or benefited from an economic development program about would they have done it had they not got it? They might say yes. They might say no. I don't know if you could bank on that.
I agree. That's not something that I would trust.
Yes, Co-Chair.
The audit of the point of well Business taken. Oregon.
That money.
One of the items that it highlighted in that audit was the significant difference between the cost per job created in an enterprise zone in an urban area versus a rural area. And this gets a little bit at your question in a sense. It's hard to determine in that case, although there's this great disparity about the reason obviously more jobs are created in the urban area is the interest in locating businesses in urban areas, the availability of qualified employees in urban areas, the ability to deal with other suppliers in urban areas. You can go down the list. So do we attribute the greater success in urban areas to the enterprise revenue or the enterprise zone incentive, or is it simply the nature of the area that that you're looking at in terms of the future development potential?
Co-Chair McLean, Senator Devlin, that's a good question. First and foremost, as auditors, we'd want the data to be available. If it is, say, hypothetically, much more expensive to create a job in a rural enterprise zone, that's kind of a policy question that I think, I guess the best way for me to answer it would be that we'd want the data available so that policymakers could judge whether that's a cost they want to, that increased cost is something they want.
Follow up.
Yes.
One of the issues we've had, and I think Senator Thatcher and Representative Wisnett would concur with this, is on the Oregon Transparency website, we've improved some of the reporting for some of these incentives we have, but there are still incentives that we have that we just don't have the data to judge whether or not, and outside organizations that look at this have basically faulted us in a sense. Some have faulted us for the very incentives, but others have faulted us that we have no measurable criteria to indicate whether or not this is making a difference or not. Is there a way we could more systematically address that? I mean, start to pick off the remaining pieces, in a sense? It's sort of like I can make almost an analogy to the debt situation. Obviously, if you have all... Some of the times when you get that report, I've seen all of those audits, you have this enormous amount of debt owed to the state. But it's different types of debt. And part of it's probably recoverable with only modest efforts. Part of it's probably never recoverable. So what is the process for doing what is possible first and maybe prioritizing this? And so how in these proposals, making the analogy back to Business Oregon, how would we go about evaluating which one of these we can start getting more data on earlier if we can determine what the data is that we should have?
Co-Chair McLean, Senator Devlin, that's a good question. I'm not sure I've got a ready answer for you. I mean, there's various criteria you could lay out about which questions or which economic development programs are most important to you.
Yeah.
It could be the money on the line, how much money's on the line, what you're trying to achieve with those objectives. Yeah. But that's just kind of off the top of my head.
Okay.
Well, Senator Thatcher?
Thank you. I was just thinking that most of the objections that I've heard over the years for not putting some of these economic development, results online is it violated privacy and perhaps trotted into the areas of proprietary information, things like that. I'm wondering if there's a way to get at that information and give us enough information without, disrupting that that proprietary part, be able to get that information. Is there a way to figure that out? Is that a work group thing with DOR and some stakeholders here to figure out? I mean, because I think it depends on which program it is and what criteria you'd look at.
Yeah.
I think they're all different.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate all the information today. If there are no other questions.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Before the Secretary of State's staff leaves, just to put on the record, we may need a few more weeks to get our recommendations to you. We'll probably do that more formally, but just so if you're going back to the office, we may need a few more weeks.
Thank you very much. Well, at this time, I think that our staff has done a good job of putting together some information for us as we go to number two, which is the committee discussion regarding audit criteria and recommendations. And so I'd like to start by looking at the second page, which were potential risk factors, potential risk categories, and then other considerations. And I thought if you'd like to, Teresa, give us a little bit more background on where you found this and what you learned.
Sure.
Members of the committee. Before we move to that, I would like to highlight, if people haven't accessed it after our discussion about liquidating delinquent accounts, LFO does do a review of those each year, and there is a publication out there which gives you some more information.
Okay.
May not answer all those questions, but there is some information there that might be relevant as you think about that subject. So what we did was kind of take a look at other states. We went to NCSL and went to individual states. You know, Oregon is kind of unique in how audits are conducted here. A lot of states, without doing a formal review, I won't say most states, but a lot of states, by constitution, the audit function, both financial and performance, is actually in the legislative branch. So Oregon's different that it's in the Secretary of State's office, although there's always been a discussion of whether that's really all performance, et cetera. But 45 states have some kind of audit or performance evaluation function office within the legislative branch. So we are a little different in that Oregon has one, but it's kind of housed in LFO, and the committee has had fits and starts, if you will. But looking at those other agency or other organizations, a number of them actually don't start with criteria or kind of a large database. They actually do a risk analysis first and say, we're going to look at some risk factors. And by looking at those risk factors, then we will kind of go into what are the list of things that we would look at, and then maybe they sit and they would actually apply the criteria and say how many of these criteria actually apply to this audit that we would want to do or review. Obviously, the big ones there are going to be both size of budget, and a number of states I would note have just moved from it being kind of immediate budget to looking at size of budgets long term. Where is there a trend that you have a part of your budget that's growing rapidly? The complexity, number of fund types, are there maintenance of effort requirements, that kind of thing. So, for example, if you go into human services, there are, I couldn't even tell you how many different account types and how many different requirements from all over are on that budget, but that would be there. Complexity of programs, policies, the essential nature of the program. So I've listed kind of examples that I think would fall into there, like 24/7 operations, or if the performance deficiency impacts really were public safety in nature or affected large numbers of Oregonians. The significance of the deficient performance. In other words, is somebody's personal safety or economic well-being, I mean, how much is it going to affect somebody versus it might be difficult, but if you're in a licensing agency, if that agency went down for a while, do we have a threat of actual personal safety, or is it maybe not quite as dangerous a situation? Significant change in leadership, frequency, number, likelihood of a performance failure based on other information. So, for example, if we've bought a system that's the same as 14 other states and 13 of those 14 are having huge performance issues, we probably should be in looking at ours before we wait for that to be an issue. And other recent crisis or issues, you know, whether it's an agency that seems to have a significant number of lawsuits, they've had personnel issues, we've had a concern about the reliability or availability of information, that kind of thing. Some states put these things into risk categories rather than these factors. Economy, and that's where you get into things like waste or fraud. Efficiency, kind of for the dollars we put in, what's the output, and are those ratios, that gets into some of the best practices from an efficiency standpoint. And then effectiveness, appropriate procedures to implement the policy or legislative direction. Adequate assessment of the program service factors. I mean, you can see the things I've listed here.
Yeah. Yes, we have a question over here. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one quick question. When you talk about the dollars we put in, does that also include something about what it leverages? Like, what if it's 1 to 10? We put in a dollar and $10 come from somewhere else.
Yes, I would say in the complexity of budget, that would be there. So, and size of budget, we wouldn't care about just being state funds. It's how many dollars are being spent on Oregonians in this state. So, and then other considerations, some are similar to what you heard, is the topic auditable. Although I can't remember offhand, but there's two states now that actually go in, and if the answer is no, that creates an automatic separate review about what do we need to do to make it auditable in some fashion. So it's kind of an interesting trend. Is the topic timely? Will it actually provide new insight, or has the problem already been identified and the work to be done is really the issue? The Secretary of State's office, Will Garber, mentioned the Human Services audit about employee morale. There would be a number of people who would say, everyone knew that was the issue there, that there was really nothing. They may not have done it, and they quantified it, but was there anything there that was really a new insight? Or, and I haven't gone back to look at it, or are they actually supplying some information about, we all understand that's the situation, what are some things you should consider doing? So it's that kind of an issue in terms of looking at it. And should the audit work plan include a risk ranking or reasoning? Now, they'd probably be a little dismayed to say, could you apply a risk ranking to those 300 to 400 ideas you have about what the risk is of one of those being there, so that you have not just a what does it feel like we should do this year, but you actually have some methodology to pull out of that list of 400 which ones should come to the surface. And again, these states do this very differently. And approach it very differently, but some states actually do take all of the ideas that come in and do a risk ranking with reasoning behind why they then select which ones they do within their state audit functions. And a number of states do have, which is interesting, within their audit functions, they have the financial audits, and then within performance audits, they have kind of a split between audits that are truly following kind of yellow book audit standards and reviews, a little different though than what we heard in terms of how the Secretary of State does that, but items that are less about is this program or agency doing the best job they can do as efficiently as they can do within the law and within the resources, which typically would be, I think you were getting at this a little bit, Senator, that that's the issue versus saying, well, just put more money in, but within that. Whereas the reviews have a little more wiggle room to look at best practices. And
we've got one more question over here.
Thank you for what you've done, Teresa. Have you, did, looking at the other states, you said 47 states.
45.
45 have the legislative audit within the legislative function.
Or program evaluation office. They're all a little different, but yes, some kind of function.
As a, I'm not a manager, but if I was a manager, I was a leader in the legislature or the executive branch, I'm looking for an audit to tell me if I'm doing it right, and I'm looking at finding ways to do it more efficient and save money. Did you get any state you saw that had a, you know, a bottom line like that, that what you're, you know, the like the morale. I pay someone $150,000 or $200,000 to head an agency. They better be in, that's their problem. They better do it, right? Morale and some of this other stuff. But
well, again, everybody does it a little differently. There, and again, I'd have to go back and look at all my notes, but there was a state that is now dividing their review staff into those people who are kind of looking at what went wrong, and those people that are just looking at, are there ways to take these programs and become more efficient? So if you will, a little more on that line of saying, okay, these, we're just going to look at best practices. That's it, rather than kind of auditing something, they're looking at best practices and then seeing how that would apply to their state and to their state program. So it's a little bit of in reverse. Instead of starting with, we're going to audit, I think we used the example of an addiction program, it would start with, we're seeing best practices in states where they feel like, you know, they're doing a lot of promotion of, they're making great headway in this area. Now we're going to take what somebody else is doing and feeling like they're doing very well, and we're going to apply that and see how our state is doing.
One quick follow-up.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When we started this and we talked to Secretary of State Atkins and then Secretary Richardson coming in, the my view of Secretary of State audits is, I said, they have no hammer. They have no enforcement. So what? How is that addressed by other states, that they have a hammer and enforcement? Or?
Well, a number of the states would say that's one of the reasons it's in the legislative branch, because they have the hammer. And I do think that's what you heard from the Secretary of State here, is we want you to use our audits. We want you to be the hammer and to do that. But it's just a different relationship. But, you know, even in a number of those states, they would say that not all of the findings are automatically going to be implemented, because, again, you're no matter how you do a review, you're doing it a little bit in a vacuum. And, you know, for example, as we talk about transparency, you know, the issues, there may be a number of things that we can do those things. There may be a few things, could be federal law. Well, you're still going to have a finding there, but there may be a place where the best a state legislative body could do is urge Congress to change the law.
Right.
Yes, co-chair.
Teresa, in terms of the 45 states where they have an audit function in the legislature, did we look at how many of those states actually still have a separate audit function outside the legislature simultaneously? I'm thinking more about the question here is, clearly our Constitution makes the Secretary of State the chief auditor of public accounts. The question has been the authority to do performance audits and where that actually belongs. And so I'm just wondering, some of those states where there's maybe a legislative audit function, there could be an audit function outside of this. I mean, the basic audit function, some of the principal ones are the auditing of the use of federal funds, that it's required to to receive those funds. So I think that would be an interesting question. And I think as we move on in this, I think one of the things I see in these various requests forms is you can see that at least in some of these they've made an effort to, rather than just say go and audit XYZ, they've asked for what's your reasoning, what is the issue that you need to address, almost in the same sense of like when we put in a bill, they not only ask for the concept, but they ask for, you know, what's the issue you're trying to address? Has this issue been been audited recently, or is it in the case of a measure, has this been introduced recently? So, but I think this is a good start.
And co-chairs, members of the committee, as I was looking at these other items, I happened to note that a number of states had that kind of a process for members to submit information. And given that we were just starting this process, I thought you might just want to see that there may be some ways to actually create a form that we would have on our website that you could access that would help you gather information as well.
Well, I would think it would also help the citizenry. Because, I mean, if I was going to ask the state to do an audit, where would you start? You know, I mean, just the idea that you've got a process. But before you have a process, I think you have to have the criteria on what you're trying to achieve with the program. And I was kind of amazed as a newcomer here that there wasn't actually this list of risks that you would put toward a topic before you chose what the topic is. So I guess my feeling is that if we get some work done on that it gives you a foundation for everybody to understand where we would spend precious dollars even on audits and why we would do it. So I'm hoping that this committee has some, I guess, feeling of obligation and or at least passion to try and go forward with some conversation on a criteria or a risk analysis on audits that we do before we even think about if we're going to expand or change audits at all. But
so, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Several of us have been thinking about that for many years already. I know Senator Thatcher and I have talked about this many times. And the Constitution, of course, gives the Secretary of State the financial audit, but that's all. Mm-hmm. It isn't something that we haven't been thinking about for a long time.
Good.
Thank you. Yes. I'll just make a comment. Thank you for what you're saying. I agree with what you're saying. But, you know, we're spoiled when I look at these forms that Teresa's provided us from other states. You know, we're used to just, as the Senator Devin says, on our LC request, it's pretty simple, but if you're going to have to get into some of this stuff that they're talking about, it'd be more difficult. But I think you'd have to provide more data than probably we do in a legislative request, because you're expending more than just the LC drafter. You're expending an agency to do something. Mm-hmm. So I'm okay with that. Mm-hmm. I think it could be, because what we just sort of threw out were topics and not specific what we're going to do with that. But and I do think. There's no one from the Secretary. We're on camera. I think we need to continue to look about the performance audits.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
Chair, I thought I'd highlight this since Ms. McHugh provided us. I just looked up the Maine OPDGA, and literally their reports, the second report that's listed is an evaluation of the New Markets Capital Investment Program, and it's titled Current Portfolio Projects Produce Positive Outcomes, Cost Effectiveness Could Be Improved. So there, an analysis of an economic incentive program. It's pretty detailed, actually.
So does the committee want to think about it, look at some of the material that was handed out, and have us put it back on the agenda for more discussion at a future meeting?
Madam Co-Chair, if members have some ideas of things they would like added, or if they want to get that to me, I can update information, and I could even mock up an organ form if you would like me to do that for the next meeting for review.
Okay. Representative Matheson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think just as important as figuring out criteria for selecting what audits you should, you know, you're interested in doing, it's also important to, if not codify, find a way to be explicit about what you expect to do after the report is written.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like the biggest problem we have right now is audits are done, but there's no assurance that much is going to happen. There are some where we find out, oh, an agency has pursued 4 or 5 changes, they've changed their processes or whatever, but maybe there were a dozen things recommended, and what happened to the others?
Mm-hmm.
Other reports, you wonder if anything happened, mm-hmm. and then 2 years later, had things improved? I'd be interested in a conversation about how one goes about it, detailing what the next step is. Okay, so there's a report, then what happens? Does it go to the executive branch? For the executive branch to think about how to execute the recommendations? Does it go also to the legislature to think about, is there a budgetary impact? Or maybe part of the problem, occasionally we heard in response to questions about things,
yeah.
a member of an agency would say, well, we can't do that because the statute doesn't let us. Well, then why don't you recommend a statutory change? If the law is getting in your way and it needs to be modernized, that's what we're here for. Let's fix it for you.
Mm-hmm.
But even some of that simple follow-up, there just seemed to be no connection to actually doing a next step.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like for us to talk about how to ensure something happens other than just the publication of a report.
And it looked like, to that representative, it looked like the Secretary of State's office was saying they at least do check in, and they at least, you know, follow it for 3 years. But again, that's just step two.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea of step 3, 4, 5, whatever it takes, if it's legislation, then legislation. But I agree with you that we're not just looking at risk factors. We're also looking at how to complete the process.
Madam yes. Chair, I can take a look and see if other states have any information about how they do follow up as well.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any other comments, questions, thoughts on this issue?
The only thing I would add to your list of suggested audit topics, which I failed to do, is there are 3 bills that actually direct an audit to be undertaken. And I will update for when I bring this back, I will bring that. But they are Senate Bill 351, which requires an audit of the statewide summative assessment in public schools. Senate Bill 435, which requires an audit of the state forestry department expenditures and specifically lottery funds used for purposes related to federal forest lands. And House Bill 2977, which requires the Secretary of State conduct a cost analysis of collective bargaining agreements prior to execution of the agreements.
Yes. Co-chair.
One of the things I think the co-chairs of this committee in the next week or so are going to have to think about a process to kind of refine this list and narrow this list. I don't know how many requests we should actually submit or if there should be an expectation if we submit like 5 requests that the secretary may select from those. I haven't had a chance to discuss this with Representative Nathanson, but you know, there is one very specific one I can think of here. There are more issues than this, actually, in the Department of Revenue. But one of the things that we have seen in the Department of Revenue in our recent review is a fairly alarming percentages in terms of their key performance measures about the reactions from Oregonians to the Department of Revenue in terms of their satisfaction. Now, normally you wouldn't necessarily be satisfied with interactions with the Department of Revenue.
Mm-hmm.
But their satisfaction levels used to be in like the high 70s. And now I think they're approaching the 20s or 30s. And we tried to even do some brief examination. Was this a change in criteria of how it was done? No. Was this just simply attributable to the problem they had last year in terms of their increased oversight of refunds and their longer that it took to actually do those refunds? Probably not just that. But there is something happening there that we really don't know what is happening. And the way Oregonians are reacting to the department, although there are other issues now in the Department of Revenue, that's an area that I think getting to the bottom of that, what is the underlying problem? It's not that people are ever going to be
really happy with having to call the Department of Revenue or being called by the Department of Revenue, but something has happened in the last 4 or 5 years that's putting them down to a level that you'd have to question what is actually happening there.
So,
Senator Riley.
So I think in that regard, though, it should look at what other agencies and across Oregon and across the country have the same results, because my guess is that almost every government agency across the country has been slipping in
actually,
that regard for
actually time. Not so much, but it depends how the question is asked.
That's right.
And what are the questions being asked, but that's probably one of the questions in the Department of Revenue, but there are more things arising. As you well know, there's some, as recently as 6 months ago, we were being told all the IT projects in the Department of Revenue were going well.
And we know better.
And we know better now.
Madam Chair,
yes,
I had last year after the tax season, I had more calls from constituents than I've ever had as far as complaining about the returning their check, they're mailing their checks, and they talked about the reason I got from the revenue was that the computer problem. Blame it on the computer.
Yeah.
It used to be the dog, but now it's the computers.
Okay.
Well, I think that was a good discussion to get us started on really trying to have a framework that we can all agree to that will help us have better audits that actually get implemented as far as suggestions and thoughts on improvement. So thank you for that today.
Okay. Are we going to do our third item?
Wait, there's a third item. It's the Legislative Fiscal Office Overview of Performance Measures.
Oh.
And he has waited patiently.
So we get a substitute.
Yeah.
We were going to get Rocco, but...
he's actually in charge of it.
The committee, Paul Siebert, Legislative Fiscal Office. I was just going to give you an overview today a little bit about the key performance measures and performance measurement in Oregon. Oregon's been doing performance measurement for a long time, starting in the 1960s, all through the 70s and 80s, but through this time it was pretty much driven by the executive branch, and mostly focused on outcome workload type of measures. Starting in 1989 with Oregon Shine, some of you might have heard about that. That was a statewide strategic plan that began a renewal of interest in performance measures in Oregon, mostly more on the outcome and how the state was doing toward achieving its strategic plan. And to that end, they adopted a benchmark framework, about 100 performance measures that tied to the Oregon Shines. In 93, the legislature passed legal framework guiding or dictating how performance measures would be done in the state. A lot of that's still in place. And most of it was tied to having state agencies look at their performance and how they could tie that to the benchmarks. So it was an exercise in having your own measures, but seeing if you could link them up to the benchmarks and then the Oregon Shines. And all agencies were free to develop their own measurement systems, use their own terminology, and that kind of created a lot of problems. Because they would use different terminologies for output or outcome, and you couldn't really get an idea of the same what people were talking about consistently. The other issue was that we had issues with agencies changing their measures a lot. So you would get one measure, you'd be okay, this is the performance measure, we understand that, and then maybe the next time up you see it, they wanted to change it some. So you would never really see any kind of time series, and there was no control over the change mechanism of when changes were allowed or they weren't. So the legislature was a little bit frustrated. So in 2001-03 interim, a performance measure advisory group was convened that established guidelines for developing performance measures for the 2003-05 budget cycle. They determined that you needed a uniform approach to identifying and reporting all these performance measures in a system that was based on legislative expectations, was useful to managers and line staff and to the program people and the folks running the programs, and had a good mix really focusing on outcomes, not just outputs or widgets, trying to get it at, what are we getting for the investment that's being made, kind of? So to ensure that that was happening, the guidelines required each agency to present their performance measures during their budget hearings to Ways and Means Committee. And that's been going on since then, since the 03 session. They've been doing that. These measures became known as the key performance measures, and so each subcommittee then reviewed and formally adopted the measures. The idea behind this then was that there was a set of controls in place so that you didn't have changes constantly in measures, and also you could, again, legislature could focus things on, focus in measuring on programs that they were interested in or areas they found problems with. So that's, again, that's been going on since 03, still happening. But in the early stages, it was really beginning, you know, when it first started, there was a lot of some confusion, but just it was new. So some agencies were required to kind of come back with another set of measures with other changes during the interim. And what they did was they had most analysts had those agencies return to this committee. And so during the 05 session, they added the performance measure review to the duties of JLAC because the agencies were being directed during the interim. Remember, there was no annual session, so they were being directed to come back and have the JLAC look over the proposals for new measures or changes that were unhappy with the first set of proposals that were being made. And that started again about in 03 interim and the 05 interim. But then after that, some resources were added, but really we've been doing this without any resources added to either office for BAM or LFO. At the started out, it was really kind of a joint process with the executive branch and the legislative branch. Not too long after they got some positions, BAM got a position, they had to cut it during part of budget cutting. And so essentially in 2008, legislative fiscal took over responsibility for the system. And we've been running the system ever since 2008. With the person in our office, June Starkey really is the person who's been really running the system for us. She's our information systems advisor, and she worked tirelessly with agencies on a system that DAS built a number of years ago that was, you know, wasn't the greatest, had its issues, and became more problematic as the years went by reporting and working with. Our analysts have to work in the system, so essentially agencies go into the system, input their measures, input any changes they want, input their data, and then the analysts go back after a work session and put in our recommendations and any suggested changes that the committee might have for the performance measures. So again, that really has been done since 08 by LFO. And the committee, JLAC, really didn't have much input after 05. Well, of course, as you know, they weren't really meeting for a while. And then the system got up and going and was developed and kind of institutionalized within the Ways and Means process. And I think the budget analyst became more comfortable dealing with performance measures and analyzing performance measures. And the agencies, I think, did too. And so, you know, we, again, have those KPM reports that are attached to the budget bills. Most recent development is starting in with December e-board request, DAS came in for a rebalance, and the Legislative Fiscal Office worked with them to find some money, just under $70,000, to redo the current system because it really was becoming unworkable. And again, June Starkey, our office, served as a project manager, and DAS provided a little bit of money to redo a complete rewrite of the system. And she worked for many, many months with the developers to complete the process. And I have to say, we've gotten some great reviews so far about the system. Agencies find it much, much easier to deal with. Analysts have found it's much easier to deal with. So we're really happy with the way the state of the system now and for reporting and dealing with KPMs. So I should also note that not only it goes along with the budget bill, and the work session report, as just what you see there is a snapshot of the measures. You see the current measures as approved, some targets, and one data center. The real, the most of the data is reported in the annual performance progress reports that every agency is required to submit. These are also done through the KPM system. You'll see copies of those in agency budget materials as part of their appendix for their information they submit during their Ways and Means review. But if you really want to see, you know, how an agency is doing on the performance measures, that's where you need to look, is at in their annual performance progress report, because you'll see the time series over many years, you'll see the targets, and there's also some fields for them to explain, you know, explain their results, maybe why they're not achieving their target or why they're over target. So I think those are really useful for members to review, especially during the budget cycle. Part of the rework of the system was we had a number of fields in that APPR, we call it, the Annual Performance Progress Report, that were really weren't used much. For example, looking at comparison from similar agencies or jurisdictions of from other states. We weren't getting good data in there, so we removed a few of the items from the APPR that agencies had to report on to lessen the burden on them and to focus more on what we could control and what we could look at here. So we took care of some of those out of the system. We think it's a lot better system now. They're just starting to publish the reports. You should be able to see the new APPRs. I think the graph, just technically, they look a lot better. The text looks better. The graphs are a lot better to work with. You can read them a lot easier. So, you know, as far as the system goes, I think we're in a good place for a performance measure in Oregon. We have been doing it for a long time. Like I say, since 2003, we've been dealing with the process of having them approved in Ways and Means. And luckily, in many other states, what happens with performance measures is it kind of goes up and down with interest of the executive branch. We haven't had that here in Oregon because it's a legislative process that's been institutionalized. It's been ongoing ever since, and I don't foresee it going away anytime soon, regardless of which co-chairs come in, regardless of which party's even been in control. It's been a system that's gone through, and I think the legislators have found value in the system and in the performance measures that got reported out. Now, I should note that what we're talking about here and what you see really is key performance measures. So those are the ones that are the higher level and that focus on outcomes that the legislature might be interested in. Many agencies also have what we call internal performance measures that they do for tracking workload, things like that. You might think of more of the outcome or the output kind of measures, because that's important for them to just track their workload and deal with their budget. But those are mostly held internally, and we try to focus on, you know, the outcomes of performance measures. Mm-hmm. One of the problems with performance measures is some areas it's much easier to measure performance than others. Senator Thatcher, you mentioned about economic development. That's always been one of the hardest areas to measure, I think, in performance measure. You know, ODOT, road conditions, a lot easier to measure, you know, and performance measures for things like that. So it can be tricky, but I think most agencies have worked hard and gotten into a good place into what they've been measuring and what they report to you. The one thing that we try to focus on is to make sure that KPM's agencies have at least some reasonable ability to affect the outcome. So there's sometimes a tendency to have agencies measure or track information or progress on a measure, for example, like delisting of a salmonid species. The legislature is very interested in it, but the effect that an agency can have on that probably is pretty small. So there's that kind of tension sometimes between which measures you ask to get reported and what agencies can actually do to affect that, move the dial on that measure, so to speak. But that's kind of the basic background and history of the performance measure. I didn't want to spend a lot of time because I know you guys don't have a lot of time today. But I'd be certainly happy to answer any questions or give you any more information.
Any questions or comments? Yes.
If we were considering an audit in a particular agency, it would be relatively easy for us to get the latest key performance measures from that agency.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, that's correct. All the APPRs are supposed to be on the transparency website over at DAS. I think the Most recent one's 2016. 2017 one would be out in the fall, I believe, is when those get issued. But you can always look again through every budget bill that passes. You'll see some information on their most recent data and what their targets are going to be.
Madam Chair, I might also state that the example that Mr. Siebert gave was a real example. We did have a key performance measure at one time, and I can't remember if it was for OWEB or if it was ODFW, and it basically said your key performance measure is how many species has U.S. Fish and Wildlife delisted?
Okay. Well, it looks like we have other folks coming in for our next meeting, so I do want to thank all of you for coming today and helping us know a little bit more about the different performance measures and everything else that we're working on as far as the risk analysis and what audits we think we should be doing this year and beyond. So thank you very much. Unless there's any issues or items for the good of the order, seeing none, I'm going to close the meeting for the Audit Committee for